Good to be with you again, and appreciate the stimulating time we had last night. One quick announcement I'm going to make is I regret that I have run out of a number of book titles. You know, when you're flying Delta, there's only a certain amount of things you can bring with you, and I get a little benefit there, having flown a great deal. I have what they call million-mile status. There's two ways of getting million-mile status. One is to fly around the world 20 times and then to the moon and back and put all that together. You know, the moon's 240-some thousand miles away, and put those together and you get a million miles that way. The other way to do it is to fly in the United States a lot, and that's the way I did it. But as a result of that, I have status where I can carry up to 2 70-pound bags without charge. Without that, I really could not carry on the ministry in the way I do it. But at any rate, there still are limits, and I've run out of several titles. What I am going to do, try to do this during the break. If not, we'll get it done during the Sunday school or during the noon hour. I'm going to set out a sign-up sheet back there where any books that you wanted that I've run out of, that if you put your name down, I'll send them to you, and I have a further policy that if you pay in advance, then I do not charge any postage. So I'll have that set out. And anyway, so that's the next best thing. What we're going to talk about this morning is the basic beliefs of the Founding Fathers. We saw yesterday that the vast majority of them were strong professing Christians. Today, we're going to see how those beliefs made their way into the Constitution. And we titled the message, The Founding Fathers' Fivefold Formula for Freedom, and seminary homiletics professors would probably give an extra good grade for the alliteration. Whether there's any sense behind it is a secondary issue. But there are two basic things that would unite all of the Founding Fathers in their views about law and government. And these would be, first, a high view of God and his law. And second, a low view of man and his nature. Sir William Blackstone certainly stressed this idea of there being a high view of God and his law. Blackstone and his commentaries, which were very influential among the Founding Fathers, but Blackstone emphasized there are essentially three categories of law. As he described those categories, there is first of all the revealed law, which Blackstone said that God has made these known to us, and the doctrines thus delivered we call the revealed or divine law, and they are to be found only in the Holy Scriptures. And then he went on to speak about the law of nature. And Blackstone, as many before him, Luther, Calvin, and many others believed, is that there is a universal law of nature that God had written on the hearts of men, as we see it described there in Romans chapter 2, verses 14 to 15, and he says concerning the law of nature, this will of his maker is called the law of nature. For as God, when he created matter and endued it with a principle of mobility, established certain rules for the perpetual direction of that motion, so when he created man and endued him with the will to conduct himself in all parts of life, he laid down certain immutable laws of human nature, whereby that free will is in some degree regulated and restrained, and gave him also the faculty of reason to discover the purport of those laws. He goes on to say that all human laws rest upon the revealed law and the law of nature, and no human law should be suffered to contradict these. He says concerning the law of nature that no human law is of any validity if contrary to this. Now, concerning the relationship between the law of nature and the revealed law, Blackstone said that they cannot conflict because they are both the will of God. But he goes on to say that the law of nature, or the law of the revealed law, he says, is a law that we have written in black and white, and therefore we clearly understand it and we know what it is. The law of nature, he says, is what we suppose it to be by our imperfect powers of human reason. Therefore, he says, if there is any apparent conflict between the law of nature and the revealed law, we resolve that in favor of the revealed law. Luther had put it in a very similar way when he said that natural law is the Ten Commandments. And that, he went on to say, the Decalogue was not of Moses, and God did not give it to him first. Rather, he said, God gave the Decalogue to all of mankind in this unwritten law of nature that all of mankind understood. But he goes on to say it was never as perfectly expressed as it was in the Ten Commandments. And the Ten Commandments, you could say, are a summary of the biblical law as a whole. More on that when we get to the Ten Commandments this afternoon. But this law of nature is something that the Founding Fathers believed in very strongly. Jefferson, in the Declaration of Independence, said that we are entitled to our independence by the laws of nature and of nature's God. Words that he took almost verbatim from Blackstone. He goes on to say that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are evolved equal. Wait, he didn't say evolved equal. He said created equal, which is the only firm basis for a belief in human equality. He went on to say that they are endowed by their government with certain negotiable privileges. No, he didn't say it that way either. By their creator with certain unalienable rights. And the only way you can say that rights are inalienable is to recognize that they come from a higher source than man. And what source could that possibly be but God? Hamilton, a very profound thinker, one that there'd be a few respects in which I wouldn't entirely agree with Hamilton, but his idea of a national bank, for example, his broad construction of the Constitution, but Hamilton declared concerning the rights that we hold, the sacred rights of mankind are not to be rummaged for among old parchments or musty records. They are written as with a sunbeam in the whole volume of human nature by the hand of the divinity itself, and can never be erased or obscured by mortal power. So this first principle, then, that there is a higher law, is a limiting power on government. Human government and human laws are valid only to the extent that they are consistent with this higher law of God. And you think about it for a moment. You go back to the Nuremberg trials of the Nazi war criminals. What basis did we have for saying that what those Nazis did was wrong? They were following orders. They were following orders that were consistent with the written law of the land at that time. The only way we can say they were wrong is to say that there is a higher law that supersedes even the laws of the Third Reich or the laws of the United States. And without an understanding of that higher law, there is really no basis on which we can say there is such a thing as an unjust law. Now, talking about a higher law of God is not particularly popular in legal circles today. But an argument I would make is that any lawyer who has ever taken his case to the highest court in the land and lost and comes out there saying we were dealt an injustice, whether he realizes it or not, he is saying he believes in a higher law. Because how can any decision of the Supreme Court possibly be wrong or unjust unless there is a higher law that we compare it to? This idea of the higher law of God is one of the first principles that all of the Founding Fathers, the Christian majority, and the few who were not, would be united upon. In fact, the deists would believe in the higher law of God just as strongly as the Christians would, and they might emphasize it even more strongly, this idea that everything in nature, including human affairs, is governed by these unchanging and unchangeable laws of God. The second part of this principle, then, is a low view of man and his nature, a high view of God and his law, a low view of man and his nature. They knew that people are not basically good, as the framers of the French Revolution thought they were, that human nature is not perfectible. Man is, as the Bible describes him, a sinner, self-interested, corruptible, ambitious. And two things come out of that. First, it means we need government. Man's nature is such that he cannot live in a state of anarchy. Anarchy is not going to be a state of total freedom. Whatever freedom there is going to be very quickly destroyed by people running roughshod on each other's rights, killing each other, assaulting each other, robbing from each other, enslaving each other. In other words, we need government in order to preserve order, but also in order to protect liberty. And without government, the enjoyment of liberty is going to be impossible. But there's another aspect to this too. And that's that those who run the government have the same sinful nature as everybody else. That doctrine of total depravity, as we call it, is a great leveler. It means the king and the parliament and the governors and the chief justices and the policemen there on the beat, they all have the same sinful nature as everybody else. And that being the same, being true, we cannot trust them with absolute power. And so we need to establish a government that has enough power to govern, but at the same time, we need to restrain its power. Hamilton, again, put it very well at the Constitutional Convention, where he made the declaration, "Take mankind in general, they are vicious. Their passions may be operated upon. Until the millennium comes, in spite of all our boasted light and purification, hypocrisy and treachery will continue to be the most successful product in the political market." And we have to take man as he is, and we have to design a system of government that recognizes that and makes that basic nature work for the common good. Now, Patrick Henry believed just as strongly as Alexander Hamilton did in the depravity of human nature. Henry was raised in, you might say, a mixed marriage. His father was an Episcopalian, a devout one. His mother was a Presbyterian, an equally devout. It's said that Henry inherited both the stability of an Episcopalian with the fervor of a Presbyterian. He was taken to church Sunday morning. He was required to take notes on the sermon and recite those notes during the dinner hour afterward. But Henry believed in the sinful nature of man just like Hamilton did. But their solutions were a little different. Hamilton thought we need a strong central government in order to keep the sinful nature of man in check. Now, he wasn't under any illusion that those who run the government were free of sin, but he said their vices are less harmful to the public good than those of the masses. And therefore, he said there should be a natural aristocracy that rises to the top and that runs things. Henry was much more concerned about abuses of power at the national level. In fact, for that reason, Henry was even opposed to the Constitutional Convention. He said, "I smell a rat," and refused to attend the convention. And he was one of those who refused to support the Constitution afterward. There at the Virginia Ratifying Convention, as they're debating whether to ratify the Constitution or not, it is Patrick Henry, old and in bad health at this time, but standing almost alone against the leading minds of the nation at the time, George Washington and John Marshall, who would be Chief Justice, James Madison, and the many others who were arrayed in favor. And Henry argued against the Constitution, came so close to persuading a majority not to ratify that the proponents of the Constitution finally made a concession, and they said, "One of your objections is the lack of the Bill of Rights. We promise that as soon as this Constitution is ratified, we will immediately go to work on the Bill of Rights," which they did. And Henry deserves a lot of credit for having forced them to do that. By the way, Henry supported the Constitution afterward. after the Virginia Ratifying Convention voted by a very narrow margin to ratify, there was a group of anti-federalists outside that were ready to riot and do some damage. Henry said to them, "The Constitution has been ratified. We are all Federalists now. I suggest you all go home." And Henry was probably the only person in the state who could have said that persuasively, and they did. Well, I don't know if they went home or not, but anyway, they left. It's the old saying, well, the place is now closed. Doesn't mean you have to go home. Just means you can't stay here. But anyway, Henry opposed the Constitution. And he did so partly on the basis of his view of human nature. One of the speeches he gave concerning the Constitution there was, "Where are your checks in this government? Your strongholds will be in the hands of your enemies. It is on a supposition that your American governors shall be honest, that all the good qualities of this government are founded, but its defective and imperfect construction puts it in their power to perpetuate the worst of mischiefs, should they be bad men. And, sir, would not all the world from the eastern to the western hemispheres blame our distracted folly in resting our rights on the contingency of our rulers being good or bad? Show me that age or country where the rights and liberties of the people were placed on the sole chance of their rulers being good men without a consequent loss of liberty." Now, probably Thomas Jefferson believed more strongly in human goodness and emphasized the concept of sin less than did most of the other framers. But after he had been to France, and after he had seen firsthand the horrors of the French Revolution, a revolution that sometimes is compared to the American War for Independence, but was very different. It was a mob that were ruled by a group of self-appointed thugs. They first go in and seize the Bastille to liberate all the political prisoners in the Bastille, and they did, all seven of them. Slaughtered all the guards, who, by the way, were unarmed. Then proceeded to launch a reign of terror where they exterminated all the aristocrats, and when they ran out of aristocrats to exterminate, they started exterminating each other, which I would argue was the only good thing they ever did. And it finally took the dictatorship of Napoleon to restore order. And France has never been the same since. In fact, the story is told about somebody who walked into a library in Paris and asked for a copy of the French Constitution, and the librarian said, "I'm sorry, sir, we don't carry periodicals here." But after Jefferson saw all of this, he came back to America, and his faith in human goodness was somewhat shattered. And in the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798, Jefferson wrote, "In questions of power, then, let no more be said of confidence in man, but bind him down from mischief with the chains of the Constitution." Chains of the Constitution, to bind people down, particularly to bind government down from mischief. We were in a battle several years ago in Alabama with the desire of some to create a new state constitution. The real purpose of it is to enable the government to tax more. But I remember serving on the governor's commission concerning constitution reform, and we had several hearings where people came, and it seemed like most of those who were coming to testify why we needed a new constitution were either state employees or representatives of state employee associations. And they emphasized to us over and over again, you know, the main problem with people in Alabama is they don't trust their government enough. That sound you just heard was Thomas Jefferson turning over in his grave. Okay, so these two concepts then. A high view of God and his law, a low view of man and his nature. James Madison really expressed the basic problem so well and stressed the nature of their solution to it. When in the Federalist Papers, in Federalist number 51, he makes the statement that we need to set up checks and balances so that each branch limits the power of the other. Not because they are public-spirited and are operating in the public's best interest, but they check the power of the other branches in order to preserve their own. In other words, it wasn't well-meaning, benevolent rulers doing things in the public interest. It was power-hungry congressmen overriding the veto of a power-hungry president, and in turn facing a power-hungry Supreme Court. But as each of them checked the other to protect their own power, in the process of doing so, they preserve American liberty. Ambition must be made to correct ambition, Madison said. The interest of the man must be connected with the constitutional rights of the place. It may be a reflection on human nature that such devices should be necessary to control the abuses of government. But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? Think about that statement a moment. Government, a reflection on human nature. I would argue that probably more political theories go astray and don't work in practice than for any other reason other than the main reason that they are based on a false view of human nature. That's why socialism and communism don't work. They're based on a false view of the nature of man. If you believe people are good and you believe that people will be spirited, hard workers for the good of the community rather than themselves, you might favor socialism or communism, but it doesn't really work that way. The commissar can come out to the commune and give a rousing oration about the need to work to build the socialist motherland, and that might fire up the workers for an hour or so. But in order to get people to produce in the long run, you need the profit motive that free enterprise supplies. So Madison goes on to say, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. If we were good, we wouldn't need government. But he seems to be implying that men are not angels. He says, if angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. If people were good, or even if people are bad, if we still had a little group of wise philosopher kings like Plato spoke of, we could give them all power and they'd wield in everybody's best interest. But Madison seemed to be suggesting that those who run the government aren't angels either. And so he says, in framing a government which should be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. That summarizes the problem that the Founding Fathers faced at the convention perfectly. And so, they design a government that is based on what I call the Founding Fathers' fivefold formula for freedom. And here is that formula. Part one of the formula, limited delegated powers. The idea that the government has only such power as we the people have delegated to it, and no other. If somebody comes to you, some government official who wants to carry on some program or exercise some power, and you question him and he says, well, show me where the Constitution says I can't do this. He's got it completely turned around. It's the other way around. He needs to be able to show where the Constitution says he does have that power, or else he doesn't have that power. Now, the framers thought this was perfectly clear, but just to make sure that nobody down here in the 21st century got this confused, they put it in writing, in concrete, in the form of the 10th Amendment, which simply says the power is not delegated by this Constitution to the United States, that is, to the federal government, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. This concept that government has only the power that we the people have delegated to it is a concept that comes out of John Locke. And John Locke's idea then of the social compact really underlies the whole Constitution. And you open the Constitution and you read those words at the beginning, we the people, in order to form a more perfect union and the other purposes they set forth, do hereby form this Constitution for the United States of America. They are saying there that the Constitution is our social compact. It is the means by which we establish our government, and it's the means by which we the people delegate to our government certain specified powers. James Madison, on one occasion, was faced, and this is when he was still a congressman, before he became president. There was a proposal to provide for some welfare for a group of people that had been victimized by a storm disaster. And Madison simply said, I cannot lay my finger on any provision of the Constitution that authorizes the federal government to engage in charity. I'm going to tell a little story right now about a man that I regard as a great American constitutional hero, but who most people haven't heard of. How many here have ever heard of Horatio Bunce? A couple of you have, okay? Ken, okay, yes, you would have heard of him, good. But a couple of you have. Horatio Bunce lived in Tennessee in the 1830s. He was a farmer. He was never a man who ran for any public office, but he was regarded by his neighbors as a man who read a lot and a man who had a lot of good common sense wisdom. You've all heard of his congressman, Davy Crockett. And Crockett was running for re-election and was in Bunce's neck of the woods, and he saw Bunce and went over to introduce himself. And Bunce simply said, I know who you are, sir. You are Colonel David Crockett, our congressman. I voted for you in the last election. I shall not do so again. And Crockett asked him why, and he said, because you violated your oath of office to uphold the Constitution. Well, how would I do that? And Bunce said, remember that vote you cast in favor of relief for those fire victims? And Crockett said, well, yes, but you can't possibly begrudge that. There's such a small amount, and they were in dire need, and we even had a surplus in the Treasury. And by the way, surpluses in the Treasury are more dangerous than deficits. When there's a surplus, they find new ways of spending it. Bunce answered, it's not the amount, sir, it is the principle. You are authorized by the Constitution to tax and spend for three purposes. To pay debts, and you know this wasn't a debt. To provide for the common defense, and you know this had nothing to do with defense. And to promote the general welfare. This didn't promote the general welfare. It promoted the specific welfare of those particular fire victims. You violated your oath of office, and I shall not vote for you again. Crockett answered, you know, you're absolutely right, and I hadn't thought of it that way, and I'm not going to ask you to vote for me, but if you will call a meeting of farmers in this area, I will come to that meeting, and I will publicly apologize for that vote, and I will publicly promise never to vote that way again. Well, Crockett made the promise, and history, I don't think, records whether Bunce voted for him, but he was reelected. And in the next session of Congress, there was a bill that would provide for a pension for a widow. Looked like it was going to pass when Crockett stood up. And he simply told the delegates about his promise to Horatio Bunce. And he said, this is not a debt. This is not for defense. This is not for the general welfare, it is for the specific welfare of that widow. And he went on to say, I'm the poorest man on the floor. I can't vote for this bill, but I'm willing to donate 1 week's pay to this widow. And if we all do the same, it'll be more than the bill calls for. And with that, the bill was either tabled or defeated, but Crockett, I guess he passed his coonskin cap and found he was the only one who contributed. And he noted the taxpayers, or rather the congressmen, are much more willing to spend the taxpayers' money than they are their own. But there's a more important lesson than that out of this example. And that is, what if we had 100 million Horatio Bunces who know the Constitution, who know what limits it places on government and who refuse to vote for those who violate those limits. What if we had several hundred congressmen like Davy Crockett, who either know the Constitution or are willing to learn from somebody like Horatio Bunce? We've been talking just before this morning, several of us were talking about how we can get back to our constitutional system, and many, many things are needed. I guess the area that I felt God has called me into is constitutional education, which is what we're trying to do here today. Anyway, the first part of the formula, limited delegated powers. Second part of the formula then, separation of powers. The powers that we do delegate to government, we separate. We separate them vertically, federal, state, and local. We separate them horizontally into the three branches of government, legislative, executive, and judicial. We were talking, I believe it was a supper last night, about whether or not these are biblically founded, and you can certainly find in Isaiah where Isaiah says, "The Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king." Judge, judicial power, lawgiver, legislative power, king, executive power, and then he will save us. You see the two kingdoms there as well. So the idea is there, and you can go through the ancients, and they recognize these three functions of government. Now, they didn't always separate those three functions into separate branches, but the concept of the three functions was there. But separating them into these three branches certainly is consistent with the scriptural view of the basic functions of government. Now, one thing else I might just add is you could possibly see, and I'm not saying this is where it comes from, but you could possibly see a concept of the three functions of government in the Trinity. That you look to the Father, it is the Father who plans things, he sets the agenda. It is the Son who is the executor. He is the one who carries out the plan. It is the Son who actually did the work of creation. It is the Son who did the work of redemption. So you have the Father as the legislative branch, the Son as the executive branch, then the Holy Spirit like the judiciary. It is the Holy Spirit who interprets the plan and who applies it to us. So you see the three concepts there even in the Trinity. Now, if you're looking at the Constitution, and you want to know where to find something, you can see this in the first three articles of the Constitution. Not completely, but if there is something dealing with the legislative branch, usually that will be in Article 1. For something dealing with the executive branch, usually that will be Article 2. Something with the judicial branch, usually Article 3. So if you remember that, that helps you to know where to look when you're trying to find a certain provision that deals with power or limitation of power on the government. Okay, so we've seen the first two of the fivefold formula, limited delegated powers and separation of powers. The third part of the formula is checks and balances. The framers knew that if we just separate government into three different branches and let them go their own way, each of those branches will usurp more and more power for itself, and we will have a three-headed tyrant instead of just a one-headed tyrant, which is almost as dangerous. And so they said, we must set things up in such a way that the branches check each other's power. And we see these checks and balances throughout the Constitution. Congress has the authority to pass laws. Not all laws, but those laws that relate to the subjects to which power has been given to them, and you find the power is given in Article 1, Section 8. But the president has the power to veto a law of Congress. There's a check. There's a balance to that check. Congress has the power to override a veto by two-thirds of each House of Congress. And then, of course, we have the judiciary branch, the Supreme Court. And the judicial branch, as it's been interpreted at least, has the authority to strike laws of Congress or actions of the president down as unconstitutional. Now, whether that was the intent of the framers is open to some question, and I think an argument can be made that most of them at the Constitutional Convention did anticipate and favor the idea of judicial review. Without judicial review, there isn't really much of a means of keeping the other two branches of government in check. But there are also constitutional limits on the Supreme Court. For one thing, the president nominates the judges and justices, subject to being ratified by the Senate. When the Supreme Court makes a decision and decides a statute or interprets that statute wrongly, Congress has the authority to amend the statute to change it, in which case it'll go back to the same Supreme Court that misinterpreted it the first time, but maybe this will make it better. Congress and the people have the authority to amend the Constitution, and so there are a number of checks on the court. The Congress, of course, also sets the court's budget, and if the Supreme Court issues a decision that Congress doesn't like, and then later that year they submit a proposal to Congress that they need a new central air unit for the Supreme Court building, and Congress looks at this and says, well, let's see, is this that same court that made that idiot decision? We're going to table this until the summer is over. And, of course, the court has to rely upon the president and his officers to interpret the statutes, or to apply and to enforce its interpretations. You think about that a moment, and Andy Jackson is supposed to have said, and there's a question whether he actually used these words, but the concept was certainly his when the Supreme Court issued a decision he didn't like, and he particularly didn't like the Chief Justice, John Marshall, and he said, well, John Marshall has made his decision, now let's see John Marshall enforce it. And so the court does have limits on its power. There's another limit on the Supreme Court, one that most people don't know about and that is very seldom used, and that is Congress has the power to limit the Supreme Court's appellate jurisdiction. This is clearly set out in Article 3, Section 2. Where we read, in certain cases, in all cases involving ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, those in which a state shall be a party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. That is, they can hear a case that comes directly to the court, not just one that's appealed up to them. And that's very few cases. In all the other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction. That is, lower court decisions get appealed up to them, and they get jurisdiction that way. Shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. Congress has the authority to limit the court's appellate jurisdiction. Some people say that this is interfering with the separation of powers. No. This is a check on the court that the Founding Fathers placed in the Constitution. And they wouldn't have put it there had they not intended that it be used. Good example of an appropriate case in which we might possibly want to use something like this might concern this idiot decision that the court just made a few weeks ago concerning that church, Westboro Baptist Church in Topeka, Kansas, that goes out across the country and conducts all these protests at military funerals, God hates America, God hates fags, and the like. I was speaking for a Lutherans for Life issues conference in Topeka just a couple of weeks ago, and they drove me by Westboro Baptist Church. It is quite a sight. First thing you see as you're driving up is a huge flagpole with a large American flag flown upside down. Above that, they've got another flag that looks much like the American flag, except that the stripes are rainbow stripes, I assume referring to the gay agenda. And anyway, then there's a huge banner across the church that says, God hates America. And these people have been going out all across the country, and they've been picketing military funerals, saying things like, God hates fags, and even when there's no suggestion at all that this military person was in any sense homosexual. But anyway, they were sued by a father of a young man who they picketed the young man's funeral, and a jury awarded them several million dollars in damages, and it was overturned by the Supreme Court, saying that this was a matter of free speech. Well, I have to disagree. I agree with Justice Alito in his dissenting opinion when he notes how personal the attacks were, and the majority really pussyfooted around that. They just ignored a lot of the things that had actually been said in the nature of these protests. But anyway, saying that there is a basis for an action called intentional infliction of emotional distress, and that the facts here clearly met those criteria, I think he was correct. But the Supreme Court's decision is there. Now, there may well be proposals in Congress for a constitutional amendment to protect military funerals, or any funerals for that matter. I would suggest that a simpler matter would be for Congress to just simply pass a statute that guarantees that protesters will need to keep a certain distance away from any military funeral, and then simply say as an additional clause, the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court over cases arising under this statute is hereby rescinded, and the court is out of the picture. Now, I don't suggest that they do that often, but occasionally it's appropriate to use that check, and I kind of think this might be an appropriate occasion to use it. Now, the checks and balances not only go among the branches of government, but also among the levels. The framers thought they had placed some checks by giving the states certain powers against the federal government. One of those concerned the United States Senate. Now, you elect your United States senators here, but until the early 1900s, that wasn't the case. Until the 17th Amendment, which was around 1915 or thereabouts, until the 17th Amendment was adopted, you didn't elect your senators. You elected your congressmen, but your state legislature would pick the two persons from Texas who would represent Texas in the U.S. Senate. Now, this was an important state check on federal power. It meant that one of the two branches or houses of Congress was appointed by the states. And so that meant it would be very difficult to get any kind of bill passed through Congress that the state legislatures opposed. When we adopted the 17th Amendment, we thought we were expanding democracy and giving people more voice in their government. But in the process, we also eliminated a very important check. And on the whole, I think it was a mistake. Okay, we've talked about the three checks on the three parts of the formula: limited delegated powers, separation of powers, checks and balances. The fourth is reserved individual rights. The framers did not establish the United States government to be a pure, unfettered democracy. They established a republic, a constitutional republic. And there are differences between a constitutional republic and a democracy. For one thing, a constitutional republic works by means of elected representatives. In other words, we don't send people to Washington just because they're going to rubber stamp everything that the majority of people in the district favor. We elect somebody to Congress because we respect that person's judgment. And obviously, if he votes contrary to what the people want too much of the time, we're not going to respect his judgment anymore, and we will not reelect him. But if all they were to do was rubber stamp what their constituents want, we wouldn't really need a Congress. All we would need is just a very sophisticated form of Gallup polling, where we just take a poll of every congressional district and determine everything like that. But we elect people to represent us because we respect their judgment. Also, a principle of a constitutional republic is that, as John Adams said, the very definition of a republic is an empire of laws and not of men. A principle of a republic is that the king is under the law, not over the law, and everyone in government is under the law. Now, one possible source of this concept is the Persian Empire. You think about Daniel there in Daniel chapter 6. Babylon has been conquered by Persia, and Darius, the uncle and father-in-law of Cyrus the Great, is now set over the province of Babylon, and he's appointed all these presidents and governors and satraps and the like, as the Persians in their earlier years definitely practiced a form of decentralized government. That changed as the Persian Empire continued. But remember, they all get together and they're going to plot against Daniel. And it's so interesting the way they do it. We read that they sought to find occasion against Daniel. In other words, they went through his record. They checked every tax return he'd filed to see if he'd ever committed fraud. They checked every expense account he'd ever filed or to see if he'd been charging personal expenses to the governor. They probably even looked at his telephone bill to see if he was making personal calls on the government line. They couldn't find anything wrong in the way Daniel had conducted himself, and that forced them to face the real issue. We shall find nothing against this Daniel, except it be concerning the law of his God. And so they went to Darius, and they told him they had just drafted a decree for him to sign that would say that for the next 30 days, nobody may ask anything of any god or any man except through the king. It was an idiotic rule, and I'm sure Darius had a very busy 30 days, but they kept emphasizing, this will be the laws of the Medes and the Persians that changeth not. And it didn't change because they understood that once a law went into effect for its duration, even the king was bound by it. He was powerless to change it. Now, if Nebuchadnezzar had issued a decree like that, which he never would have been that stupid, he could have just simply said, what? You mean I signed a decree like that? We'll take care of that. That law is hereby rescinded. Darius couldn't do that because in Persia, the king was under the law. Concept of a constitutional republic. But another concept of a constitutional republic is that, well, the majority generally runs things. The minority has certain rights that even the majority may not take away. I heard it said very well once that the difference here is that a democracy is three wolves and two sheep planning dinner. A republic is three wolves and two sheep electing somebody to plan dinner. A constitutional republic is a situation where nobody has authority to plan dinner for anybody else, and the sheep are armed. So are the wolves, but at least things are equalized. But the idea here is that if Congress passes a law that violates the constitutional rights of the minority, the court will strike that law down as unconstitutional. Because in a republic, a majority generally runs things, but a minority has certain rights that even the majority cannot take away. Now let's look at the last part of the formula, which I'm going to describe as responsibility through religion. Now the framers used that term religion quite often. And usually when they did so, they used it pretty much consistently with Christianity. Those terms were pretty much interchangeable in their view. But they understood that Christianity plays the eternal role of the salvation of souls. But they understood also that it plays a temporal role, that of creating moral character. You see, they understood that people need control. Either that is going to be self-control, self-discipline, moral virtue, or else government is going to have to supply the control. And human nature being what it is, people don't naturally have that kind of moral self-discipline. And so, that's where religion comes in. Besides saving souls for eternity, religion creates the kind of moral character that makes responsible self-government possible. Creates the kind of society where People are going to tell the truth most of the time, even if they could get away with lying, in which people are going to obey the law even if the policeman isn't looking. That kind of disciplined populace means that we can run a community without having a policeman on every street corner, although we still need one, but not quite as much. Without that, you've got to have a policeman on every corner because people can't be trusted. It is religion that creates that kind of self-discipline. John Adams, our second president, simply put it this way. He said, "Our Constitution is made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate for the government of any other." Washington, in that farewell address, said, "Of all the disposition and habits that lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports." And he went on to say that, "Let us indulge with caution the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion." He said, maybe with a few refined minds it can, but not over the long run. Can your children live as God-fearing people, live as law-abiding people, without the religious faith that you've implanted in them? Possibly so. But I doubt whether your grandchildren or your great-grandchildren will. It's possible, morally and spiritually, to live on inherited capital, but not for a very long time. And so that's the role that religion played. After that farewell address, 20 clergymen wrote a letter to Washington thanking him for the things that he had said about the role of religion. And Washington wrote back to them, thanked them, and simply said, "Religion and morality are the very pillars of civil government." It said that as the delegates filed out of the Constitutional Convention on September 17th of 1787, a lady approached Ben Franklin, and she asked him, "What sort of government have you given us, Dr. Franklin, a republic or a monarchy?" And Franklin answered, "A republic, if you can keep it." That's been the challenge for the last 200 plus years, and we'll address more in the next hour to what extent we have kept the republic. With that, let's take a break. Did you want to say something first? 15, it's 5 after 10 right now, so we'll break until 10:20.